Hey guys, welcome to the new episode of the Andy Social Podcast. And once you're done here, make sure to head over to Goat King Riders Club,
where we never let grammar get in the way of a good story.
Good yarn.
Yarn? Story? Yeah. Fuck, doesn't matter, does it?
Well, it does when we're doing the promo for it.
Oh, well, that's what they're getting.
Also, come and check us out on YouTube for full video versions. Enjoy the show.
You're back. Welcome to the Andy Social Podcast. And you know what I'm going to say before we kick into this week's episode, come and join me on Patreon, patreon.com/AndyDowling. It's a great way to support this podcast, and support starts from only $1 a month. If you want to pay a little bit more, you get access to an exclusive Patreon podcast that comes out every Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. Lots of fun, lots of dumb stuff. And it's a massive way to contribute to the reoccurring costs of running a podcast, hosting and editing, gear, et cetera, and the more that you guys get behind and support it, the less stress I'm going to have of having a podcast that costs money. And it makes me focus on just getting really, really cool, exciting, fun people on the podcast to share these great stories with you all. So consider it, patreon.com/AndyDowling. Would love to have you there. Flick me a message and say hello. Ahoy! Episode 250! 250! We made it! My God! Is this a milestone number in podcasting? I don't know. But I'm making it a milestone, and I've got a milestone guest. Who is it? Well, you know who it is because you clicked on the episode. It's Shane Heal, NBL Australian basketball legend. A bucket list guest for me. I've had Shane on my list of guests to have on the podcast right from day dot 5 years ago when I started this podcast. And to be honest, in the early days, I was a little bit intimidated to reach out to Shane. But here we are, episode 250. He is an iconic name in Australian sports. Pretty much every Australian will know who Shane Heal is, even if they're not a basketball fan. And for any of my overseas listeners, you may know the name. If not, you're soon going to know who he is. He is just an iconic name in Australian sports. 15 years in the NBL. He's a four-time Australian Olympian. He was Rookie of the Year back in 1988 for the Brisbane Bullets. NBL champion in 2003 for the Sydney Kings. He played for a whole bunch of different NBL teams. He did two stints in the NBA, played for the Minnesota Timberwolves in the late 90s, and also did a small stint with the San Antonio Spurs, playing alongside, you know, Tim Duncan and Tony Parker, and played underneath Greg Popovich, you know, iconic players in the NBA and people in the NBA. He's had an amazing career. Since all that, he's gone off and started businesses. He's an entrepreneur. He's got his basketball show, thebasketballshow.com.au. Go and check that out. They're just about to kick off the WNBL season, which I think by the time this episode comes out would have already started. So go and check all of that out over at thebasketballshow.com.au. He's got his own basketball camp, elitebasketballdevelopment.com.au. I will have all the links in the show notes and videos. I'm talking about lots of stories. We're going to talk about a bunch of stories in this podcast. There are videos on YouTube. I'm going to dump them in the show notes. I'm just, as you can tell, I'm pumped. This is one of these surreal guests from my childhood that I'd just be pinching myself just, you know, from years gone by, just knowing, oh, one day I'm going to be talking to Shane Heal. And here we are, a little bit of a fanboy moment. But enough crapping on from me. Please enjoy this great chat with the legend himself, Shane Heal. I saw that you retweeted a picture a couple of days ago of Stephen Marbury and Kevin Garnett, and you made a quick comment just saying, great mates, but geez, they used to argue a lot, something along those lines. What the hell would that have been like walking into a situation where you would have had these larger-than-life personalities, and obviously it being your first sort of stint in the NBA as well? What, I mean, just looking at those two, I think, oh, man, they would have been a handful.
Yeah, it was funny actually because, you know, they had their posse that they used to have, you know, come to games and follow them around and all the rest of it. And they were superstars. And obviously KG was there first, but they sort of grew up a little bit together and knew each other. So there's a little bit of battle as well. So I remember one game, finishing the game, and we got on the bus, we're on the road, and those guys started arguing at the back of the bus, and they just continued to argue, and no one said anything for ages, and it got really, really personal, and until a couple of the veterans had to step in. But I remember the bus was really dark, and those guys were just arguing and going at it. I'd never heard anything like it. It was amazing.
I mean, I guess from Marbury's point of view, I mean, his career really sort of, I guess, went to the next level when he went to China. But, you know, for KG, I mean, obviously he's like, you know, iconic in the NBA. And just, I think that was sort of the larger than life personality. He just looks like an intimidating guy anyway, let alone sort of being on a team and sort of being a part of, I guess, all the theatrics and the fireworks that would have been going on.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, KG was, you know, when you're 7 foot and you can do the things he was doing, he was playing as a three-man back then. So he was sort of one of those first guys that had that size and the skill to be able to do what he was doing. And he was only a teenager. I think he signed for $126 million over 6 years when I was playing there in 1996-97 with him. So it was incredible stuff. And Steph Marbury, he was just way different, unbelievably talented, but more a street baller. Difficult to fit into a system, so he frustrated some of the older players a little bit, I think. But, you know, good guy. They both treated me really well. I had a lot of fun with both of them.
What was it like? I've always sort of been very self-conscious as this, you know, short, bogan Aussie kid, you know, getting around the world and meeting lots of different people. And whenever I go to the US and I meet different people, I feel, I don't know if you've ever felt the same way, but you sort of feel just a little bit uncultured in comparison to other parts of the world. Did you find that sort of walking into this team where you've just got these guys who've got this swag and these big egos, and obviously, as you said, with KG getting this massive contract and you sort of walking in with, obviously, you already had these massive accolades back home, but to come in there, I guess you would have been a bit of a small fry compared to everybody else. I mean, how did you sort of feel that you fit into it all?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. I was definitely a small fry and hadn't achieved anything on the NBA scale. I guess I was fortunate enough that I'd just come off the 96 Olympics, so was able to perform pretty well against the Dream Team in a few games and on the world stage. So it gave me a little bit, you know, of a head start rather than other international guys coming in that these guys didn't know about. But still, you start at the bottom rung, and especially back then, it was way different than what it is now. You look at our guys now, there's a respect there that Australians can play basketball. Mm. In 1996, there was no respect that Australians could play basketball, and there was a real insular sort of mindset from the Americans that they didn't think anyone outside of America could play basketball, really. So everyone had to do their run and do their time. And you even remember guys like Petrovic that you know, he hardly got on the court, you know, for years, and ended up being, you know, a superstar before he tragically passed. But, you know, that was part of what you had to deal with as an international player coming in for your first year.
Did you find that for yourself there was an extra level of pressure because really before you there was just Luke, who was there with the Bulls? And I think that might be it. I mean, I could be wrong. There might have been somebody else sort of that might have popped up. Did you feel pressure?
No, not at all. I actually felt the other way. I felt like there was less pressure because no one had actually really got there. And, you know, Luke's 7'1", he went to college, all the rest of it. And I'd sort of done it through the Australian, the NBL and playing for Australia. So, yeah, I didn't feel like that. But I felt like I belonged, you know, right at the start. It was just more about trying to earn the opportunity to be able to showcase what you can do. And I was in a difficult situation because I'd signed for a 3-year deal, but because Steph Marbury was only 19 and erratic, they brought in Terry Porter as that veteran guy to be able to sort of guide him to be the backup point guard. And it was always about, you know, the 3 years for as far as the club's point of view is they were really patient, whereas I was really impatient. And it was like, I'm like, what the hell am I doing sitting back here? I should be playing minutes. I know I can perform. And it was very frustrating for somebody that sort of hadn't really had to experience that.
I guess, especially for you, because you'd already carved out a pretty good career in the NBL, and obviously with the Olympic stints as well, you know, you've tasted that, I guess, the ego that would have been attached to you and what you'd been able to, you've been able to prove yourself, like, I guess, in certain different circles, and so, and on the global stage as well. So I guess that sort of is in the back of your mind coming into the NBA, saying, look, if you just give me the time, I can show you what I'm made of.
And I think once you get there, you're sort of a little bit unsure of how you're going to fit in, how you're going to perform, whether you actually belong at that level and the rest of it. But once you sort of realize you tick those boxes, then you're looking at it saying, hold on, I need a chance. And, you know, I remember in one game against Washington, we were down by about 20, and I got on at three-quarter time and had 11 in the last quarter, and gave me some confidence to go to the next game. And then we came back home, and the next game, similar thing happened, and I had 15 in the last quarter with 5 threes against Seattle. Mm. So I remember calling all my mates and saying, how good's this? I'm, you know, now I'm going to get some court time. I'll be in the rotation. This is awesome. And the next game I got 16 seconds and didn't get on for the next five games after that. So you sort of ride the highs and lows of where you think you're at, and then you have to be able to dust yourself off. And I look back at that period in my career and think, you know, that's on me for not being able to sort of, you know, deal with that mentally. Whereas I look at someone like Patty Mills, he hardly got on for his first few years and he's waving a towel, and, you know, maybe he's been able to learn from those sort of things to be able to then show what he can do at a later stage in his career.
Yeah. You mentioned that Seattle game. Where I was at the time, I was a young guy living up in Rockhampton, of all places, and obsessed with basketball, like a lot of kids sort of around that sort of mid to late 90s. And I just remember watching, it must have been like an NBA countdown or something like that, because I don't think we got the full game. Because if we did, we got like one game a week, as you probably would have remembered, late at night, Ed, in Australia. And I just remember watching one of those countdowns, and they showed the highlights of you hitting those threes in that last quarter against Seattle. And I just remember going out the back with this wooden backboard, shitty little, you know, basketball hoop, throwing these over-exaggerated threes over the back of my head like Shane Heal, trying to drain these threes, thinking, oh, I can do this. I can do it. I'm this tiny little fat white kid who could do the same thing. And I think, you know, for yourself, sort of, I think even though you weren't there for a long period of time and not as long as you were envisioning, no doubt that opened up a lot of minds for other people to go, fuck, I think, you know, there's a chance for a lot of others out there in Australia to be able to do the same thing.
It's funny, actually. You bring up a good memory playing in Rockhampton. What a court that was. I love that stadium at Rockhampton. But it's amazing how many people sort of come up to me and say that that's what they used to do as a kid, and exaggerate the shot over their head and all the rest of it. So it's always a nice memory and something nice to hear.
Yeah, it's I actually didn't even think about it until a couple of days ago, and I was writing some notes out, and I started, you know, the usual go around on YouTube and have a look at different things, and reading a couple of articles, and I'm like, oh, that's right. I just got thrown back into this old memory, and I thought, oh, geez, you know, what's happened since then? But it's cool, and I think, you know, just to see obviously what that opened up, and you mentioned before, like, you know, at that time, I think, you know, players in the NBA, Americans sort of just thought, well, the NBA is for Americans only, and anybody else that can get an opportunity to get their foot in the door, really, I mean, good luck, but, you know, really it's a showcase for us and us only. And these days, I mean, it's such an international game in that league alone, let alone, you know, how much influence it's had globally. I mean, and the amount of Australians that play in the NBA now and are legit, you know, legit making a footprint is incredible. Like, I would never have thought that back in the early 90s.
No, for sure. And, you know, we know the Americans can be pretty arrogant, and it was certainly like that, you know, back in the day. But now we see some of the international stars, not just from Australia, but around the world, that dominate the NBA. And I think the NBA is better for it, and they know that they're better for it, and the different styles that come with it as well. But, you know, watching guys like Joe Ingles now start in the NBL and be able to work his way up to be a significant player, and play such a vital role for Utah has been really impressive.
One of the things I read online, I think it was one of like a article about you reflecting on your time with the Olympics and obviously going into the NBA. And it was just one quick comment, and I made a note about it because I just wanted to find out a little bit more about, I guess, mentors or just even the journeymen who were playing in the NBA around the time that you were first in there. And there was a quick little tidbit in the story about Terry Porter and I think sort of breaking in rookies. And I think he sort of made a comment or tried to break you in as, you know, the traditional sort of rookie goes and picks up the bags. And I think you had a little bit of a stab back at him.
Yeah, yeah. We actually, it was a bit more of a stab. He sort of went pretty hard at me carrying his bag and stuff. And, you know, I look back and probably I was probably a bit out of line because, you know, I told him I wasn't carrying his bags and wherever he left the bag, it'd still be sitting there. And it's exactly what happened. I think I embarrassed him a little bit in front of all of the veterans. And then he'd sort of always come in and just jump in front of the tape line and things like that. But, you know, I was a bit stubborn as well and had a bit of pride. And, you know, he'd come in and jump in because what would happen is you'd line up and to get taped and there might be five or six people in line. And so you'd wait for your turn and Terry would just walk up and jump in front and say, no, 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 mate, that's done. So I say, no worries. I'll just grab the tape and go and tape my own ankles because Americans aren't used to taping their own ankles. Right. We've done it since we were a kid.
Yeah.
I feel like I can do it just as well. So just to shit everybody, I say, well, I'll do my own ankles, mate, whatever. You take it. Fuck, I don't care. And I'd go do it. And everyone's in shock saying, you know how to tape your ankles? No, 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 you can't do that. You can't do it like we can. But Terry was great. We ended up becoming, you know, pretty close. And it was like we sort of earned a little bit of respect from each other. But he was just what a player he was. And he was older then, so physically he couldn't do it. But I was amazed at the effort and the recovery and the extra work that he put in. We were sort of pretty aligned from the work ethic point of view.
Well, I think it was him. I was looking at the roster from that year. I think it was him and Sam Mitchell who would have been the main journeyman who were sort of in that roster that year. Did those guys sort of stick around sort of in your mind or at least stay in contact after you'd moved on from the Wolves?
Not really. I mean, sort of when you move on, you sort of move on a little bit and you don't want to hang on to guys that are playing in the NBA. You get so many people that hang on whilst you're there. So I didn't. I spoke to Sam a couple of times because obviously he became an NBA coach. He called me about Nathan Jawai, who they ended up trading for and getting at Toronto. So, but Sam was a great guy. Tom Gugliotta was another one that was a superstar that year, probably one of my closest mates on the team. And, you know, he was an all-star that year, 20 and 10. But we had a lot of fun off the court and, yeah, good memories.
How's the culture in that team? Because I've been a massive Wolves fan since I was a kid. Just you just pick a team, and you just run with it. No logic behind it whatsoever. You just go, oh, that's my team. And I'm sure you can agree, there's probably a lot of frustration over the eras of the Wolves even now. But I guess the culture back then and what you experienced in that short space of time versus when you went back years later and did that small stint with the Spurs and with Popovich and those guys that were in that team. I mean, what was the vibe or the difference that you noticed straight away between the two? Obviously, a less amount of time in that later stage, but was there contrasting sort of experiences?
Yeah, contrasting culture right from the start. And, you know, you sort of always appreciate, you know, clubs giving you an opportunity. Minnesota did that and Flip did that. But the biggest thing, probably the difference was from the leadership of the coaching point of view, and you don't want to talk badly. Flip, he's not here now. But, you know, there's a balance of looking after your players but setting a culture and discipline as well. And I felt like in the first stint there was really a lot of ass-kissing going on for the superstars rather than a lot of discipline and a lot of direction and accountability more than anything else. That's probably the main word. And I think I was only at the Spurs for I was surprised I even made the Spurs roster because I'd already retired. But I went in there and the 3 months I was there was fantastic because I got an opportunity to be able to see how that whole system worked and Popovich and Tim Duncan, the accountability that he had for what was expected across the board, and that simply wasn't there at Minnesota. And it's such a big thing when you've got a superstar like Tim Duncan that wants to be coached, can be coached, and sets the tone for everybody else. It was probably easier for Popovich to be able to lay the foundations and have everybody else come in and fit into that system because of the way his superstar responded.
With I guess the cultures that sort of these contrasting cultures, and I guess even, you know, prior to the NBA and sort of having, you know, this pretty incredible career in the NBL, did you find that sort of you had different types of, I don't know if you've ever sort of had mentors in your life or classed, sort of had an official sort of title for people like that in your life, but did you have sort of people navigating or giving you some direction before, you know, the NBA during your NBL sort of career, going through the NBA in those two stints and sort of coming out the other side as well? Did you have sort of key people?
Yeah. I mean, Barry Barnes was a mentor of mine from the time I was 8 or 9 years of age at Dunawat Inspectors. And, you know, he coached me at a couple of Olympics, but I moved from Brisbane after my rookie year to play for Barry in Geelong in a program that hadn't won a game. So, you know, he was really hard on me. But it was what I needed as well, and I embraced it, and it certainly helped me. There's no doubt about that. And then the other person was Grant Cadee, who was one of my mates but was my manager, and he was only 4 or 5 years older than me. So when I went to the NBA, I think he might have been about 30 years old or something, yeah. and he was he was negotiating because I had 5 or 6 offers. So a couple of the people he was negotiating contracts with were Jerry West and Kevin McHale.
Wow.
And he was an NBL, agent. And all of a sudden he's doing deals with these guys. He's pinching himself. But, you know, he was a great friend and a great mentor and still is now somebody that I rely on and talk to often.
Did those guys ever give you sort of a light bulb moment in your life, like something that just sort of clicked, or you saw something from a new angle, a new perspective that sort of helped you sort of take on the next challenge?
Oh, not necessarily, but I think along the way there would be a whole lot of things that you continue to learn and you change in what you do and make adjustments and then add different things to your game and all the rest of it. So not necessarily something I reflect on and say that was a light bulb moment, but you know, I think you've got to be open, you know, to mentoring and advice and all the rest of it. And I was so hungry to succeed at a young age that I was always looking at what I could do better and what I could take from other people's games and then go practice it and all the rest of it. And there was definitely, you know, because I was pretty wild as a teenager, that I needed, you know, the right people to be able to put me in the right situation.
Were you, just on the teenager comment, were you a bit shit at school or did you did you do okay?
No, I was pretty good at school with minimal sort of effort.
Yeah.
But I lost my dad when I was 13 in a work accident. So from that point, I was pretty, I was a little bit hard to sort of control and, you know, things didn't sort of mean as much to me as far as discipline or I wasn't worried about getting into trouble or whatever. So it was, it was basketball really that kept me sort of going. That was my dream. That was where my goals were and where I was committed to on a day-to-day basis to be able to achieve.
Well, that's probably a good segue into my next little point here. One of the things that is noted on your website about different topics that you talk about when you do a lot of speaking gigs is dealing with change. And it just like rang this bell for me because this is a huge one where I think I struggle with it myself, but I've noticed a lot of other people struggle with it. And when I sort of look at holistically, like sort of your career and all the different things that you've done, I mean, you've worn so many different hats, you know, just, you know, being the player, you know, being the coach, you know, working in media now, you know, playing in different teams, different locations, different leagues altogether, like just having to change your identity along the way. And also outside of, you know, being in basketball in general, sort of going down this entrepreneurial path and building business and trying to find other ways to, I guess, better yourself. I mean, what have you learned over the years of just having to sort of pivot or change or just deal with like some predictable moments and unpredictable moments along the way? I mean, how have you been able to manage that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess from a young age, I've been thrown into change often. And I say that, you know, I've got some friends now that will have their kids and they put their kids in this regime, in this routine where they only eat at a certain time. They never go out when they should be sleeping. They all these different things. So in my mind, they're actually setting their kids up for failure.
Yeah.
Because they won't know how to deal with change. We threw our kids in, and within the first week, they were at basketball games with horns and buzzers going off and crowd and everything else. And I feel like that's how I was when I was younger, because I left to go to the Institute of Sport, you know, when I was 15, 16, you know, losing my dad, changing schools, you know, signing a pro contract when, you know, I was 17 and playing in the league and, you know, living in Greece for 3 years, going and playing in Italy, playing in the NBA, you're dealing with change all of the time. So you either, you know, you sink or swim. You learn to adjust and evolve and keep an open mind about things. And, you know, when you're standing in a supermarket in Greece and no one else speaks the language, yeah, and you have to try and work out what's going on and what actually the food packets are saying and the different things like that, you learn to evolve and keep an open mind. And I find a lot of people don't like change and don't embrace change. So I could say to you, you know, we're going to change this and this, and straight away people will put a wall up and say, nah, it won't work, it won't be any good, rather than actually giving it an opportunity. And a lot of the times when people do, they reflect and go, you know what, that was actually better. I'm glad we made that change because we were able to move forward. And it's a common thing that I think a lot of people sort of struggle being out of the comforts of what they've always done.
I think it's two things that I noticed for myself, and I've certainly gotten better over the years as you sort of, you know, air quotes, mature. But you know, it's the micro and the macro. You know, it's the, sometimes I think we focus on, you know, the outer circle, you know, that circle of concern where you're sort of looking at your environment or other people or the what ifs and the things that haven't actually happened yet, and that stops you from doing things. And when change comes along, you focus on those areas that you don't actually have any influence over, instead of sort of looking inwards and going, well, how can I break this down and make it small and achievable and just, you know, make those first few steps and just walk in the right direction before sort of learning to run or whatever you're going to do after that. I think it's just, I think because of structure, and as you said before, I mean, I certainly had that in my life where, you know, not so much strict sort of upbringing, but, you know, you have that sort of regiment sort of routine and things that are in place. And so when that routine's put out of whack, then you suddenly, you feel a little bit in danger. And usually, you know, the reactions aren't terribly great when it happens. But I think a lot of the time people focus on stuff that's hypothetical or things that aren't exactly in their control to begin with. And I think that's where people stop and usually sort of become the deer in headlights.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the thing, I look back now and say, well, you know, do I believe in the things that I believed in 5 years ago or 10 years ago and 15 years ago? And you make adjustments to what you think as you continue to learn. So you evolve and continue to make some sort of change as well. Not everything, but I think sometimes having an open mind and about able to evaluate different things, look at it a different way, is important for us to be able to evolve.
What was the toughest learning curve for you, sort of going between these different stages throughout your life, where, you know, for instance, it could have been changing a team or changing a league or country, or even sort of going from playing to coaching or whatever it might be? I mean, was there one in particular that sort of really stands out as one where you really had to jump over what probably would have felt like a canyon?
Well, probably the biggest one was when came out of retirement to play for the South Dragons, and they employed Mark Price, and 5 games into the season, they sacked Mark Price and offered me the player coaching role. That was the toughest, because, you know, when you go from being a teammate to actually then overlooking, you know, 18, 20 people and a squad and roles and everything else, everything sort of changes. So that was difficult, and a lot of adjustments that I had to make and learnings along the way of, you know, how to succeed. And we were lucky enough in the first year to really turn things around and have a great year and have a lot of success. But, you know, the following year was the opposite, injuries and, you know, couldn't recruit, didn't have the budgets and things like that. So you deal with failure at the same time. And in a short period of time, you go from being unbelievably successful to, you know, really disappointing year and failing for that year.
Was that a struggle for your own ego or confidence to think, oh, maybe I just fluked that first stint and maybe I'm not as good as what I thought I was? Was there any of that sort of self-talk, or was it just more of a, you had a bigger picture in mind already?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to have an ego to be able to succeed, but I've always, you know, been able to deal with setbacks at the same time and take those setbacks and understand the process. So, you know, a lot of people say, oh, back to the drawing board, like when you lose a game or have a bad season, whereas for me, it's not about that. If you've got the process in place and you understand the boxes that need to be ticked, then I think it's about looking at the things of where it went wrong. And then you're making small adjustments to the process rather than, you know, trying to change everything. And, you know, there's always, you know, things in place that you can either do better yourself or things that happen. And in that second year, you know, when you've got a really small budget compared to, you know, some of the other teams, then it's always going to be tougher. So the expectations, you know, can be a lot higher than what they should be. And if you have a couple of injuries, then it just makes it really difficult to be able to compete. And you look at the NBL now, you know, it's different days, way different days with what the teams are paying their players and the ability to be able to recruit and everything else than the way it was 10 years ago, which is great for Australian basketball and the NBL.
Yeah, definitely. That previous year when you got the opportunity to sort of transition or do a dual role as a player coach, did you already have sort of coaching as a path ahead at some stage in the future? Had you already planted seeds with people to say, hey, eventually I'm going to be looking into this coaching space, or was it more of a case of falling into it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd always sort of kept an open mind, but it wasn't like when I retired, it wasn't like, yep, now how can I sort of start as an assistant and try and build up to get into the coaching ranks here? It wasn't in my mind, and it wasn't in my mind when I went to the South Dragons either. And, you know, if you, in a perfect world, you don't want to be thrown into being a player coach. Mm. 5 games into the season. If you are trying to be a coach, you want to be able to, you know, start the right way and continue to transition and contribute and learn and all the rest of it. So, you know, but again, that's how I've always been. You know, you're in that situation, you take it on the chin and you run with it. And again, we made the playoffs. It was the first time a brand new franchise has ever made the playoffs. So, you know, you take the wins along the way as well and realize that there was some things that we did really well to be able to achieve that.
Did you have any challenges with your teammates going through that transition and having sort of that dual role, where I see this in other parts of my life where you might have a peer and you're on the same playing field, but then suddenly somebody gets an opportunity to sort of start leading or becoming that coach or becoming that manager or something like that. And so the relationship changes, that dynamic changes. Did you have any sort of resistance or friction between your teammates?
No, I was really lucky. I had a good group of guys, you know, tried to give them ownership of the team and turn them into leaders, with me being able to overlook that as the coach as well. And, you know, guys like Joe Ingles, he was only a teenager. Mm. You know, he's still a mate today that we speak to, you know, regularly, try and mentor him. And you're trying to help those guys become the best players they can. And that was one of probably the strengths that I had to be able to do that. So I was pretty lucky, really.
One of the other things that I noticed and was quite interesting about, I'm trying to get the timeline right, but I think when you retired, you started to sort of go down this entrepreneurial path and create some business for yourself. And I think you went into some Subway franchises and built this little mini empire for yourself. But not to talk so much about Subway itself, but I guess the whole thing of you going down the path of looking for opportunities in business outside of what your identity of a player and just working in basketball was there somebody in your background who was sort of guiding you in that direction, or was there any prep work that came from the NBL exiting the league to say, you know, the particular things to look for post career?
No, not at all. You know, I'd always been entrepreneurial, and you know, I'd done, you know, a lot of deals and a lot of property and a lot of things during my career. So it was a natural thing that I'd set up to become a Subway franchisee while I was still playing and buy Subways and, you know, and really built that side up. I was really motivated, and it was a really good transition for me because I could go full on into being able to build something. And, you know, when you start at something small, and I opened more than 30 franchises, turned over more than 30 million a year, and built, had 360 staff, and during the GFC the whole thing came tumbling down. So, you know, you get a few things that don't go your way, you know, along the way as well. And again, you know, I think sport you know, probably set me up to be able to deal with successes and setbacks and challenging times, because you're winning and losing every week, and you learn to be able to dust yourself off and understand the things that went wrong, things that you can learn from, things that, you know, are your fault, and things that are outside your control, and how to stay positive and how to work out what's important in life as well. And, you know, I've been very, very, you know, fortunate to have such a great family and three kids and been married 26 years and so many things that are positive. So, again, you know, those sort of experiences only make you better, you know, moving forward for the rest of your life.
Yeah, definitely. It's I think you got to be able to experience as much as you can and get all degrees of success and failure to sort of really create your own identity and to get where you are now. I mean, everything, there can't be any regrets along the way. It's got to be, it's all, I use the term too much, character building. It's definitely critical. I mean, you got to throw yourself out there and experience as much as you can. But one of the things I thought, it just, you made the comment about, you know, already having sort of that sort of entrepreneur sort of mindset and sort of being interested in property and things like that. Do you think that it was an advantage to you versus maybe somebody in the NBA, where being in the NBL, where especially at that time where the league was relatively small, there probably wasn't a lot of money going on, that in the back of your mind you knew that your career as a basketball player would be for a particular period of time, and you had obviously had that as your main focus, but you're obviously thinking long term beyond your career as well. Do you think that helped versus like somebody like a KG contract who probably just goes, well, probably not Kevin Garnett, I should say, but somebody else who receives, you know, these multi-million dollar contracts and just sort of says, well, I'm just going to focus on these millions that I'm getting right now and not really think about the long term?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when you're playing in the NBL, you always realize that you're going to have to work. And even for the money that, you know, for the NBA, you know, when you're on smaller contracts, you know you're going to have to work, and you know you want to be interested in things. I'm not the sort of guy that sort of was going to finish my career and then just, you know, go fishing. It's not in my nature. You know, I need to be motivated. I need to have challenges. You know, I want that in my life to be able to do those sort of things, and to be, for the stimulation of being able to get up every day and have challenges and set goals and everything else. So yeah, I guess it did, because I knew that, you know, once you retire, you know, hopefully you've got sort of a lot of life to be able to live, to be sort of happy with. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what it's about. It's about finding ways in everyone's life about how you can be happy with what you do and who you are and, you know, friends and family and everything else. And, you know, I think people that can achieve that have been very successful.
How much of an influence do you think you've had on your daughters? Because I noticed that they just launched a little business themselves, and it looks really impressive. And for me, I guess at that age, I would never have even thought about, you know, starting something myself. I just would have gone through the machine and come out the other end. How much of an influence do you think you've had on them and their sort of that entrepreneurial sort of direction that they're taking?
Yeah, hopefully I've had, you know, a good influence and directed them in the right way and tried to encourage them to be able to follow their dreams and, you know, do what they want to do. And, you know, two of my daughters are just into fashion. They love it. and have worked in the industry and are studying the industry and everything else. So it's like, well, if you want to do it, you know, back yourself and go through that process. And, you know, and they've done it all themselves. And you know, we have think tanks and ideas around the, you know, kitchen table and all the rest of it, but it's they've been able to do it. And, you know, they start small and be able to grow it. And, you know, but with anything, if, you know, kids find their passion, anyone finds their passion, and they're doing things that they love doing, then, you know, it's a really positive step in their own life to being happy. So, you know, I couldn't be happier with, you know, all of my kids and where they're at and what they're doing and the way they think and the people they are.
I think I've noticed in the past, past several years, where I think just going out and creating something yourself is far more welcomed. I think it's far more accepted than probably what it used to be. And I think especially in our culture in Australia, like I think, you know, I think we've always been a little bit too modest for our own good. You know, I think just historically as a culture, and I think these days, I think we're happy to back ourselves a little bit more and sort of get out there and try things and step outside the traditional framework. And so I just think, you know, just versus even sort of me sort of growing up and sort of seeing what opportunities there were or just the types of thoughts that people had or the conversation, I think these days, I think it just seems to be, far more welcomed than it used to be.
Well, and accessible to be able to do those things than what it was in the past. So, yeah, I think it's great. You see so many, you know, new ideas and things that evolve and all the rest of it from, you know, me being 50 and the way we grew up and trying to explain to my kids the way it was. Opportunities are plenty right now and people that want to back themselves and have a go. And it's not about, you know, backing yourself saying, I'm going to do this, you know, because I'm going to make $100 million out of it. That's backing yourself because, you know, you've got a passion to be able to do something and provide a service and products and things that other people can enjoy their taste and things as well. And I think that goes across the board with people being able to, you know, have a crack.
I think it also, like, you know, gives you skills that you didn't even think that you had in the first place. And I think it sort of develops things that can be utilized in a completely different setting years and years down the track, where you sort of look back in hindsight and go, oh wow, like if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be where I am now. And so I think you know, even just that life experience of getting out there and doing a bit of hustle and learning how to run business and just dealing with money and negotiations and just interacting with strangers and just trying to, you know, your reputation and even just basic customer service, all that sort of stuff it's incredibly valuable. And sometimes you just don't realize how valuable it is until later on down the track.
Yeah, no doubt. And just makes you a little bit more worldly of different experiences that you're fortunate enough to be able to embrace and go with.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's my shitty tangent. Speaking of worldly, going back to 96 Olympics. Now, I'm not going to talk about the Dream Team because I think there's plenty of info out there and you've spoken about it quite a bit over the years. So I'm going to link to stuff so people can check all that out, and I'll put a few clips in as well. But the thing that I wanted to just quickly ask you about is Lithuania. This is where, like, my interest really peaks, because I have this weird obsession with Arvydas Sabonis, and he seems to be this player who just had all the potential in the NBA, but just due to injury just never happened. And obviously he was this superstar in Europe and just still had an amazing career, but it was one of those players that you sort of say, what if? And I know that you guys played against them, and I think the question is really, I mean, what was that experience like? And obviously you're not matching up directly with him given your positions and sizes, but I mean, what sort of memories do you have of playing against that team? And I know there's a couple of other sort of powerhouses in that team. I mean, it's such a, I find them more intimidating than the Dream Team in a way.
Yeah, well, they're certainly different. And, you know, Sabonis is one of those guys, and again, it reflects on, you know, what we were talking about back in the days. You know, he at one stage, I have no doubt, was the best big man in the world and was not actually playing in the NBA. So when he was playing at his peak and playing in Russia, you know, the things that he could do for a 7-footer of being able to dribble in transition and put the ball behind his back and pass and finish and shoot and all the rest of it were unique in the world game, and he did have a lot of knee injuries and came to the NBA late. Still showed a little bit what he could do, but probably not the same as what he could, you know, in his prime. But playing against them, you know, for a bronze, you know, they've certainly been a nemesis for us, Lithuania. But having to play against him without Luke Longley was always going to be the biggest challenge. And in 1996, I don't know where we were ranked, but it would have been pretty low. You know, we might have been ranked like 10th or something like that coming in. The expectations weren't big because we didn't have one player playing in the NBA. And a team like Lithuania, you know, with Marcelinus and these sort of guys that were already in the NBA and established starters in the NBA, we're always up against it. But it was incredible that we could actually get as close as we did. We felt like we could have won and should have won. But that was the spirit of the Boomers team at that point, is that we would just fight against whoever was put in front of us. And, you know, in that tournament, you know, we beat teams that we'd never, ever beaten before in the history of Australian basketball. And so it was pretty bittersweet to be able to get to that stage, but just, you know, stub our toe at the end.
It blows my mind just sort of thinking back, you know, for me as a kid watching a lot of this happening at the time. And for me, sort of my memories is that was sort of the pinnacle of Australian basketball. I mean, obviously, you know, what the league is these days, it's incredibly massive in comparison to what it used to be. But I think as far as those characters, and I've crapped on about this quite a bit on the podcast over the years, but I think the NBL, at least, and maybe it's more nostalgic for me just because of the age that I was, but I think the NBL had these larger-than-life characters, and even going into the Olympics and, you know, as you said, like there's no one in the team who's playing in the NBA. And so on a global stage, very underrated, the underdogs, etc. But I think, you know, for a bunch of Aussies back home who have become obsessed with the NBL and the NBA, you know, pretty much that entire Boomers squad were all superstars for a lot of us. I mean, you guys were all household names for us, and we were just amazed that, oh my God, here's these big names coming onto the global stage and get to sort of duke it out with the Dream Team and all these other guys. And it was just, it blows my mind to think, I guess, the different perspectives, because for you guys going in there, I mean, you could be classed as nobodies compared to, you know, your Barclays and Paytons and all those guys, you know. So it's just interesting to see sort of through the different lenses, where a lot of us back home were sort of just going, oh my God, like, you know, it's Teal and Gaze and Bradkey and the likes who are all just sort of suiting up and going to war.
Well, and I think the thing is that a lot of Australians really didn't know, say, the best Croatian players and a lot of the best Lithuanian players and the people around the world that were absolutely superstars. So we were fighting out of our weight class, but we were able to compete, and to get to the top four was just incredible. And, you know, whilst I played in Greece, we the Greeks would always look at me and they'd say, Malaka, how is Australia in the top four? How, Malaka? Australia. And that's how they would look at us. So Australia, top four, and, you know, the Greeks and, you know, the Spanish and the Turkish and, you know, all these different countries that had so much history and so many people, you know, in their countries and that played basketball, and here we were in the top four. And it's amazing, though, because that's the way it works, because in 2000 we make the top four. We got smashed in the top four, but Australia looked at that as a massive failure. Barry Barnes loses his job, never coaches Australia again. And Australia in the last 20 years has never finished better than what we finished in 96 and 2000. We've equaled it a couple of times, but never been able to topple that and get a medal. And I think sometimes we can get ahead of ourselves very quickly, because we don't understand what's happening in the world stage and some of these other countries and how we're perceived of the success for us to make a top four in a country like Greece, where they look at it and say, Malaka, what the fuck?
Do you think we're better equipped now than ever before to get that one better?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I think, you know, there's a couple of things, though, that when you've got NBA guys that are, you know, as good as what they are and having such vital roles in the NBA and world experience and used to coming up against the superstars on a day-to-day basis, But the thing that makes it harder is how do you keep that Boomers tradition if, you know, some guys really don't have the passion for the Boomers and are playing because then they want to go to the Olympic Games and tick a box with that. But what it meant for us to play for the Boomers, that's all I cared about. That was my only goal. I didn't talk about the NBA or think the NBA or dream of the NBA. It was just about playing for Australia. So when I put on the green and gold, that was everything. The thing that we're going to have to really battle with moving forward is really trying to keep people passionate about playing for Australia when they could be making $15, $20, $30 million a season playing in the NBA. So sometimes it can become an afterthought, and sometimes it can become more about the individual than it does about the country and the Boomer singlet. So that's the challenge that I think that we've got. But as far as talent goes, geez, we are so much more talented and more equipped than what we were back in the day.
Yeah, it just blows my mind. Just thinking back to who was on that team back then, like especially for '96. But it makes sense.
So it was Gaze and Gaze, myself, Vlahov, Bradkey, right, Ronaldson, Sam McKinnon was a young guy then. You know, we didn't do a lot of subbing. We played some big minutes. But we played a style that, you know, we were very comfortable in our roles. Mm-hmm. Everyone fit in and played their piece. And, you know, it was a great team to be part of.
Was it a similar sort of thing to what you mentioned earlier about the pressure that you didn't feel going into the NBA where you sort of you didn't have anything to lose? Did you have a similar sort of feeling going into the Olympics as well, being the underdog? Did sort of let's just see how we go, or did you feel pressure or a different type of pressure?
Well, I've never felt pressured to perform. I've always felt like I am the underdog. You know, I've always been the kid that, you know, in under 12s they said I was too small to make it. So I've had that mentality of going, all right, let's go. I've been that. That's how I've had to live, and it's the mindset that I've had to have. But I also felt like I worked harder than anyone else. I knew I'd taken more shots than anyone else I played with or against every single day and was fitter than anyone that I played with. So I use those sort of things to build a confidence to say, yep, I can compete with you guys. But I know that most people really don't expect us to succeed. So you can go and throw a haymaker, and if you succeed, then it's a bonus. And but never really been scared to fail or not achieve.
Yeah, cool. Just a couple of quick things before we wrap it up. From your era in the NBL and the stints that you had in the NBL, who comes to mind first, if anybody, where you sort of think, if only, in the context of them getting a chance in the NBA, was there ever a player that you played with either alongside in a team or against where if only they had had an opportunity to strut their stuff on the NBA stage that they would have gone, done really well?
I think Andrew Gaze probably comes to mind. He had a couple of chances, but, you know, San Antonio was right at the end of his career. I think if he had found the right situation as a role player, and if the game was played a little bit more like it is today, because Andrew and I used to play the way it is now, we would come down and shoot threes in transition when really the general mindset was, you know, I took over from Phil Smythe. The point guard's meant to come down and direct and organize and, you know, that sort of stuff, not come down and come off it on ball and, you know, shoot it from a meter outside. So if Andrew Gaze had have had the opportunity to be able to play a role, I think he would have been a great role player for a long, long time and had a lot of success in the NBA had he got an opportunity earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. With where you're at now, and I think in more recent years getting into media work, did you, you know, you've got the basketball show that you're doing now, I've been doing for a while. Like coaching, did you find yourself in a situation where just an opportunity came knocking to do some media stuff and you just found yourself doing the odd commentating here and there and it sort of led you to where you're at now?
No, I mean, I started in the media really early. When I first moved to Sydney in 96, I was working for Channel 10. They had a basketball show then. You know, I'd do a weekly story for Sports Tonight and the Channel 10 News. When I went to the NBA, I came back and started commentating for Channel 10 then as well for the NBL. So I got into the media pretty early and it was a natural transition for me. As soon as I retired, you know, I went straight into commentating and you know, you sort of just go your own way and say what you think and create your own style. And that's what I did. And I've sort of been commentating now for 15, 16 years altogether. And yeah, I enjoy it. I love having an opinion and being able to point out the things that I see at the time. And yeah, some people obviously, you know, don't want to hear everyone saying what they, you know, they think. But that's all part and parcel as well. You know, you're never going to keep everybody happy, but have fun doing it.
Oh, I love the trash talking, even if it's just on Twitter, just watching so the back and forth where someone just throws this opinion that's got absolutely no substance whatsoever, and everyone comes down pretty hard. But, you know, always all in good fun, of course. But, yeah, it's quite entertaining to watch that stuff go back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, social media is different now, isn't it? Everybody can have an opinion and all the rest of it. But, yeah, you want to try and keep it lighthearted, but have an opinion. And that's sort of what we've done with the basketball show too. Like people said to us, all the networks said that, you know, a basketball show doesn't work in Australia. So we said, okay, well, we're going to back ourselves. We'll finance it. We'll do it. We'll produce it and everything else. And we started it, you know, in a friend's throwback store and a sports store in the city, and got some amazing numbers. And then last year was picked up at News Corp, and we ended up having 170,000 views across all of our mediums in 1 week. Wow. For the basketball show. So became pretty powerful, and you know, we love doing it. Again, throwing out the opinions that of what we think, because we don't have to, you know, say what the NBL thinks or Basketball Australia or anyone. We just give our opinions, and sometimes people like it, sometimes people don't, but at least they get, you know, unfiltered opinions on what we think.
I think also just having that dynamic between you and Carfino is like just gold. It's absolute gold. I think obviously you guys have known each other for a hell of a long time, and obviously that helps with the chemistry. But I think for a basketball fan, especially an Australian basketball fan, you know, you're both iconic in your own rights. And I think when you've got opinions, it comes from, you know, a knowledge and a history and experience of the league and just the game itself. And so it's fun to watch the knowledge mixed in with blunt opinions and stuff, as you said before, where you can say things that if you're under, you know, sort of the official banner of the league, then you'd be a little bit more restricted as far as what you can and can't say. So I think from a fan point of view, it's awesome.
Yeah, Carfino's great. I mean, he is an unbelievable player, retired way too early, but he's been a good mate of mine for a long time. And we mix well together because our personalities are so different. So we actually work really well, have a lot of fun, a lot of laughs as well. We take the piss a lot. It's good. And we're doing one for the WNBL this year, which is going to be exciting because there's no other sports on. Well, virtually, you know, I'm not a cricket fan. So, you know, for me, there's not a lot of other sport to watch. And, you know, this league is fantastic. We can't wait to showcase all of the talent that's there. And, you know, it's like an extended tournament over 6 weeks where we're going to be seeing a couple of games every day. So, you know, looking forward to providing a show for them.
I didn't even realise, obviously, I know the WNBL exists, of course, but I didn't understand what was going on for that league, given everything that's been going on this year with COVID. And so when I was looking it up and seeing that you guys were going to be doing the coverage for the season, I thought, okay, how long is the season going to be going for, a few months or whatever? And it's like, no, 6 weeks, all up in somewhere up in North Queensland. I thought, oh, shit, that's a short window of time to smash a lot of games out. So it looks like it's going to be is it going to be like a – oh, it can't be like the NBA bubble, but is it sort of similar concept in the sense that they're just going to keep everyone together and just try and smash it all out in a more concentrated fashion?
Yeah, so they've created more of a hub so people can come and go. They've done their quarantines. They're playing between Townsville, Cairns and Mackay. Mm. There's 8 teams in it. They're playing 14 games each in 30 days.
Wow.
So every second day they're playing a game, and then they've got bang, bang for the finals and they're finished. And they've signed a deal with, you know, Fox Sports, KO and ABC as well. So there's every game's going to be covered. Which is going to be fantastic. Yeah. This league is like, you know, they talk about the NBL being the second best league in the world. And let's be honest, the NBL is not the second best league in the world. The NBL, you know, would be aiming to try and be in the top 5 leagues in the world. And our, you know, talent has really improved. This league in the WNBL, with our Opals being second in the world, is incredible. It really is. So I think people, what'll end up happening is people will have nothing to watch, and then all of a sudden they'll see, you know, a women's basketball game. They'll tune in and go, you know what? That was actually better than what I thought. There's some talented girls in that league. So Liz Cambidge back as well. So, you know, that's going to give a little bit of emotion and some opinions for people as well.
I think it's exciting, especially having so many games in such a short space of time as well, because you're going to, like, the players are going to be tested, you know, more so than probably they have in a long time. And that's going to bring out all these different storylines and challenges and drama along the way, because everyone's going to be, I guess, back against the wall in a way. They're going to be tested, you know, in physically and mentally throughout this period. So it seems pretty cool.
Yeah, that's going to be great. My youngest daughter is lining up for her fourth season as well, still a teenager. So she's done all the hard work. So she'll be playing for Townsville. And, can't wait to see how it all sort of pans out.
That's awesome. Are you guys going up there, or are you going to do it out of Sydney?
No, we're doing it out of Sydney, so no, at this stage won't be going up at all. But, you know, creating a lot of content of stories of players that, you know, haven't been sort of told before. You know, people like Mia Murray, that she retired, had a baby, and now she's been able to come back, and the system allows for that and embraces it. And I think it's good when women can sort of do this as a job and as a sport and a passion and still be a mum at the same time. So, yeah, we want to bring a lot of those stories to light as well as being able to sort of evaluate all of the players and teams and forecast as well.
Look forward to it. You've won me over, that's for sure. So, it's really exciting, especially a very unusual sort of format compared to previous years and to the traditional format of a season. So, it looks like it's going to be unique and pretty exciting. But, Shane, thanks for the chat. People can go to, thebasketballshow.com.au, and I think all the details are there, and I'll have all the links in the show notes so people can check it out. I'm going to dump a few old throwback videos in there so people can get a glimpse of what we're talking about. But, Shane, thank you so much. Like, such a thrill to talk to you. And that little fat kid from Rockhampton throwing threes over the back of his head is pretty stoked that he's talking to you right now.
No, that's great, man. I appreciate you having me on. And, good chat.
Go and watch Shane and Co. over at thebasketballshow.com.au. They are in the midst of the WNBL season right now that kicked off on the 11th of November and goes until the 20th of December. They've got a little bit of a hub thing happening up in North Queensland, which we just spoke about in this episode. Go and check out his basketball camp, elitebasketballdevelopment.com.au. He's on Twitter, @ShaneHeal. He's also on Instagram. I'll have all the links in the show notes over at andysocial.net and andydowling.net, nice and easy, and they'll be in the show notes for whatever podcast player you're listening to this through right now. Just click on the description. There'll be a bunch of clickable links. Stab your fingers against the screen. You should be able to click through and say hi to Shane and check out his world. Awesome stuff. Now, before we wrap it up, patreon.com/andydowling. Come on over, support me, support this podcast. All the money that's been coming in from Patreon has been huge in covering the costs, editing, hosting, gear, production. And it just takes a weight off my shoulders and just ensures that I can get and continue to get amazing guests like Shane on the podcast. And it's just been absolutely fantastic. And in particular, while I would thank everybody who's on my Patreon list, the ones in particular, my social circle tier, my $10 tier, these guys are significant contributors each and every month to this podcast. These guys are just legends, and they invest in this podcast. Thank you so much, in particular, to Andrew from Perth, Mick G from Sydney, Ash from Deniliquin, Dan from Dapto, Rod from Rayleigh in North Carolina, Patrick from Canberra, who's just recently updated his pledge to $20 a month. Patrick, you legend. We've also got Liam from Brisbane, Chris from Sydney, Brendo from Leeton, Tim from Canberra, James from Brisbane, and that's it. More to come, no doubt. And a massive thank you to everybody else who's been supporting on the $1, the $2, $5 tiers. Just it's been huge. Thank you so much. And the Patreon podcast episode that comes out every Tuesday morning is getting more and more ridiculous. We've got Team Achronoplan happening over there. Stay tuned for that. If you don't know what that's all about, well, maybe you have to come over to Patreon and check it all out. But lots of fun stuff happening over there. Go and check it all out, patreon.com/andydowling. Now, next week, we're back into musos. And we've got a musician that I don't reckon you guys will be able to pick. When you see it, when you see this person pop up next week, you're going to go, oh, no shit. Wow, cool. So somebody from the Australian metal scene, somebody that hasn't done a lot of interviews, I don't think, he's a bit out there. This is going to be a really fun chat. So stay tuned for that. But until next week, folks, thanks for listening. Keep spreading the word. Like, share, subscribe, follow, fucking retweet, fucking comment, tag, share it with your mates, your mum, whatever. Just give me a bit of love. Love it. Thank you so much. Until next week, folks, take care and ta-ta. Larry, please.